My name is Amy Freed, and I'm in the Social Science Building. The date is August the 14th, 1987, and I'm interviewing Professor David Johnson about the history of the Industrial Relations Research Institute and his tenure as director. Do I have your permission to interview you?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to start out with asking you if you could just briefly tell me how you came to Wisconsin, around what date, and how you came to be director of the Industrial Relations Research Institute.
Well, I came to Wisconsin as a graduate student back in 1947. I was a field examiner with the National Labor Relations Board in Cincinnati, and the Taft-Hartley Act was being considered at that time, and the agency was pretty much in the doghouse as far as Congress was concerned. The 80th Congress, which was first Republican Congress in about 15 years, and so the agency's appropriation was cut. As a result, some of the younger field examiners were riffed. And a colleague and I, who had lost our jobs, decided to come to Madison for the summer session because of Madison, of University of Wisconsin's reputation in labor. And I stayed for the summer session, and after the summer session, it seemed to me it would be a good time to get a master's degree, so I stayed a year and a half. By that time, the Taft-Hartley Act had been passed and their appropriation had been restored, and I was invited to come back to my job, but I conferred with Selig Perlman, who was my advisor, and he said he thought that the agency would become a lawyer's agency and that I'd be wise to stay in school. So I stayed in school and ultimately got a PhD. I was a bureaucrat in Washington for about 8 years in the 50s, and I came back here in 1957 at the age of 39, a very mature assistant professor. And I've been here since 1957 in the Department of Economics. This next year will be my 31st year.
How did you come to be involved with the Industrial Relations Research Institute? Were you on some committees that eventually led you to the directorship, or?
Well, when I came back in 1957 as an assistant professor, it was then the Industrial Relations Research Center, but it really was just getting started. And Jerry Summers, who came to Wisconsin the same year I did, 1957, really was stimulating it into a bigger organization than it had been. And he and I were both labor economists, and he, as I say, invigorated the what was then the center. And any of us who were interested in labor and economics and business tended to take a great interest in it, partly because of Jerry's enthusiasm, but also Ed Young, who was chairman of the economics department at the time, was a former director of the center. And he encouraged us all in the economics department to take an interest in the Industrial Relations Center, and many of us did. You know, this was a period of the beginning of the transition from the economics department's reputation and fame in labor economics, a transfer of that to the Industrial Relations Research a center at that time, or institute later. And of course, it was the period from about the time that Summers and I came to about oh, 10 or 15 years later that represented a real transition from the economics department's reputation in labor economics, which was really a kind of a labor management or industrial relations reputation rather than labor economics reputation in the sense of University of Chicago kind of labor economics. It was during that period that the Institute took on new life and vigor and expanded, and participation of other departments besides economics became more important. But to those of us who were in labor economics at the time in the department all were enthusiastic about greater participation in the Institute. At that time, Reed Tripp had been away. He was he had been the director of the center in the middle and early 50s after Ed Young. He was in Indonesia in 1957, 58. I think he came back in 1959, and I think he resumed as the director of the center perhaps for a year or two before he went off to another university in the East. But he and Summers and I and Ed Young and of course Bob Ozan was partially in the department at that time. Elizabeth Brandeis. I came back the year that Selig Perlman retired, and also I think maybe it was the year before Selig retired, and the year that Ed Witte retired. Mm-hmm. So that some of us, although we couldn't really take the places of those people who were very distinguished people, nevertheless, our bodies took their place as they retired.
I wonder if you could comment on what you remember as the important considerations and concerns when you were director.
When I was director? Well, I guess after Jerry Summers stopped being director in 1968 and became chairman of the department, the tradition of the director, of people holding the directorship, changed. He had been director for several years, just as Ed Young had been director to this department for several years. And a new tradition was established of 3-year terms, of course, re-elected each year. I think Stern, who took over from Summers in 68 or 69, had 3 years, and then I think Jones had, he might not have had 3 years, 2 or 3 years, then Miller. And during all this time, the real power, I shouldn't say power, in academic life that isn't an appropriate term, but really the most important person in the Institute was Jerry Summers. It always was after he became director in the early 1960s, or even perhaps after he came in 1957. In 1977, I was the Dean of International Studies and Programs, and had been for about 5 years, and I wasn't anticipating an early departure from that job, but Jerry convinced me that it was time, in the normal course of events, for Dick Miller to retire as director and have a new director, and he convinced me that I should become the director. And as I say, I had another job, so I did both jobs for about 2 years or 2.5 years. The most important considerations, well, when I became director, Dick Miller had devoted a substantial amount of time and effort and his talent to a campaign to become a department. And he had written a very good position paper for the dean. And I took that as the principal task that the director had during the period that I was the director. And I guess it consumed more time than anything else for about a year and a half, at which time we made our pitch to the dean, and he turned us down. That was a devastating period for me, but at the same time he promised that he would provide incentives for economics, sociology, and perhaps other departments if they were interested to make appointments that would satisfy the Industrial Relations Research Institute. The big reason I think we wanted departmentalization was that we could see the approaching retirement of all these people who have now either retired or are about to retire, and we knew that the economics department would be unlikely to replace those people with the kind of people that the Industrial Relations Research Institute would like to have, that is, people interested in applied research and in industrial relations as a kind of an institutional edit or an institutional view. And when we were turned down, it meant that we couldn't see that the institute could survive unless we could get some appointments. And the dean recognized that and told us that he would encourage departments to appoint people half-time on the tenure track, and he carried through with this. It's not been terribly successful, but we've initiated the effort to do that, and of course the first success we had was with Paula. Sam Cohn came shortly after that in the sociology department. And more recently, of course, we've had success with I forget his name, the German professor who's coming in sociology in the fall. So that I guess that the primary concern during all my time as director was either in trying to get departmentalization or trying to retrieve the situation after we were turned down.
In regards to that, when you were proposing departmentalization, Dean Cronin, who was dean at that time, solicited the opinions of various departments on departmentalization of IRR.
Yeah.
And in a memo that I see that he wrote to you when departmentalization was turned down by the Academic Planning Committee, he says that some academic departments expressed regret at such a step. I mean, that's the way he phrased it. And I know that, was that basically because of the reluctance to sort of share resources with a new department or to lose the was it thought that IRRI would lose its interdisciplinary nature?
Well, I think everybody, not everybody, but most people think that it was largely Bob Lampman's view that impressed the dean. Bob had recently spent a year at Cornell, and he thought that the giving the institute appointment power would kind of balkanize economics and maybe balkanize other departments as well, in the sense that he could see economists in the institute, with a tenure track in the institute, economists in the economics department, economists already in the social work school of social work, and already in the urban and regional planning department, and he thought that that was not a desirable pattern. He thought that the economists ought to be appointed in the economics department, and he didn't like that general notion. And I think that the dean was impressed with that argument. I'm sure he wasn't the only one who made that argument. As you say in the memo, the dean said there were departments. I think the history department probably felt that way as well. I think they had a special interest in getting a labor historian in the history department. And now, as I understand it, they're getting one this fall. Along in the same fashion that we were able to get Paula and Sam, and as a person who will be partly on the institute's budget. So that I think that at that time they would have, they preferred the notion of getting when they could anticipate Hosann retiring, and I think they thought it was more appropriate that the history department should get his replacement than an IR department, knowing, I think, that certainly economics would never appoint another, at least in the foreseeable future, would never appoint a labor historian. So that while I say that I think it was principally Lampman's point of view and Lampman's prestige that swayed the dean, there were others too. I think Tom Skidmore probably I don't know, I shouldn't say that, I don't know, but I imagine Tom Skidmore was not terribly enthusiastic about departmentalization, and there may have been people in sociology who, and possibly political science, and even perhaps psychology that took that point of view. And at any rate, I don't think any of the existing departments were enthusiastic about departmentalization for IR. Mm-hmm. That was pretty hard to beat, the existing department's attitude. There have been new departments created. For instance, urban and regional planning was created, but I think that was special circumstances. There were some dissidents that the departments were happy to get rid of.
Do you see that this one thing that I've come across in other interviews is that it seems this, at least in economics, that the enthusiasm for the Institute arose out of a feeling, I mean, dating back to Witte's time before his retirement, and at the instigation, he being so active in the founding of what was called the Industrial Relations Center at the time, mm-hmm. was due to an impression that that economics was moving away from providing a home for the study of labor, and that it would be more appropriate, or what might be a more friendly or more appropriate home would be something that was devoted almost exclusively to the study of industrial relations, and then that would provide a way for economists to pursue these interests outside of the department. Do you agree with that point of view?
Well, I don't know. I can't reconstruct what Witte thought on that, as to whether he My feeling at the time was that he thought economics was going in the wrong direction, and he'd rather have had it stay in economics, but I guess he could see that economics was going in a different direction, and it may very well be he thought, well, we might as well transfer our interest to industrial relations. I guess his attitude is best expressed in his presidential speech and to the American Economic Association. I think it was in 1957 or 1958. The economists, I think, generally view it as a kind of a know-nothing speech, but industrial relations people read it and say, gee, that fellow really had our interests at heart. And certainly Witte felt, as you describe, whether he thought that that should be transferred to the IR Center or whether economics should be converted back to what it was in the 1930s. I don't know. Certainly was dissatisfied with the direction that economics was taking. Witte was a strange character. I mean, looking back on it nowadays, people would say he's a strange character. I remember his saying that there wasn't any such thing as theory that he thought was important, only facts. He was a great facts man.
Was there any thought when, for instance, departmentalization was turned down, that perhaps the center should be moved out of L&S into say business or into someplace where it might?
Oh, sure. A lot of people have suggested that. I don't know whether it's ever had any very serious consideration. Certainly the business faculty seems to be there are a substantial number of them. There may be more business faculty than there are from any of the L&S departments. I'm not sure, but it might be a logical move, put it in business. But I don't think it ever was such a serious proposal as to go to the chancellor or anything like that. And I think the problem with it would be that it would be opposed by some people in economics and maybe from the, to whatever extent they participate, certainly from the people in the School for Workers, for the same reason that the business people object to the idea of the School for Workers coming in to some kind of IR umbrella organization. They don't, as I understand it, they don't want the Management Institute to particularly, and if they don't have the Management Institute, they don't think they ought to have the School for Workers. Now, that kind of an organization seems to have worked out pretty well. In Illinois, they have everything in their institute, I think. Workers education, management education. I don't know. I don't know enough about Cornell. But I guess there are internal political reasons within our faculty so that either moving it into the business school or making it or bringing the School for Workers in, it's just not going to happen, apparently.
So you think that as far as it'll go will be representation on the executive committee of faculty from the business school and from the School for Workers?
Yeah, I think so. I think that as far as we can see now, it'll just stay in the College of Letters and Science. Although, I don't know, I suppose if you talk to Jim Jones, he would I have some idea that either ought to forget about it as it is. He's prejudiced against letters and science because, I mean, he's in the law school. He doesn't have to show any affection for the dean of letters and science, and he doesn't. But I think he would prefer to go to the chancellor. And I don't know, there may be some feeling that with a new chancellor, it might be possible to go to the chancellor and say, look, we want a school, separate school. I don't think that was possible with the old chancellor. I just don't think he would have done it. Well, then, I guess it seems to me that there'd be all kinds of problems with that of appointments. A lot of people would be reluctant to leave their departments and go into a school. And there'd be all kinds of questions of joint appointments. It'd be very difficult to do, I think. I guess I don't, but some of these details are fuzzy in my memory, but I suppose there were people in the business school who were less than enthusiastic about departmentalization for the reason that they didn't particularly want to be in L&S. I mean, if it was a department in L&S, it presented problems to them as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Dick, of course, who was the one who pushed it.
Mm-hmm.
Although I suppose it originated with Jerry Summers.
Mm-hmm. Wondered in terms of the funding of graduate students, whether that was a consideration in the move for departmentalization, and when departmentalization was turned down, how it was thought you were going to address the problems of supporting graduate students through a non-department.
I don't know. I guess we've always depended upon the faculty getting research money. At that time, of course, we did have the project assistance that the dean took away from us 2-3 years ago. But I don't know that the support for graduate students was any particular consideration in departmentalization. I don't know that we've done terribly well in the fellowship competition, but I think we do as well as the departments do, and we did before this proposal of departmentalization, and after. I don't know that in the fellowship competition it makes any difference whether you're a department or not, and I don't know that it makes a great deal of difference in the way in which faculty members can get funds for research. The big change was taking away those project assistantships, but I don't think that, I know that didn't occur until after we had been turned down for departmentalization. So I don't know that support of, it's a continuing problem. It was before, and I think it would have remained about the same problem if we'd been a department.
Mm-hmm.
Support of graduate students, it's just a terrible problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we lose, I'm sure, just lose a lot of good students because of our inability to have funds to support more of them. If we could only, say, get a couple of funded fellowships, that has a tremendous impact on recruitment of good students. In the Center for Development, of which I'm the director now, we used to have a lot of Ford Foundation money, and we had fellowships that could be advertised, and our students come from all over the world. And just the fact that there were a couple of these fellowships every year brought a lot of students who wouldn't have otherwise come, even though they weren't necessarily supported by the fellowships when they got here. It's made it much more difficult to recruit by not, when that Ford Foundation money ran out and we no longer have any fellowships to advertise.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to get students.
Is the Center for Development the same as the Center for International Studies? Is that
no. Center student? For Development's master's degree program, something like the Institute.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have any faculty of its own, and it's... It was created in 1967 with Ford Foundation funds, and principally faculty members in economics, political science, urban and regional planning, and in the ag school,
mm-hmm.
ag econ. Rural soci are interested in it. Now we don't have any money. We just operate with state funds now. We were lucky in the sense that the dean did not take away our project assistants because we use them to support our teaching program. His quarrel with the project assistants for the Institute was that they were used for faculty members in their research. I mean, they were assigned to faculty members for research. Ours are used to support our teaching program. They work in our library. But who knows? He might take those away from us sometime, too. He's always looking for ways to save money.
I wanted to clarify something that's been confusing to me in looking at the records, which you may be able to help me with, is during the 1960s, there was a Center for Foreign Labor Movements, which was affiliated with the Industrial Relations Research Center or Institute. And since then, there's been a number of name changes. It's been the Center for Comparative International Studies, and then...
Uh-huh.
Is that's all the same center?
I think it's all the same. The university got a couple of, well, I guess the original grant from the Ford Foundation back in about 1962 or 63, was intended to be distributed to various departments. And Everett Caslow came at about the same time. I think Everett came in 1963, might have come in 62. And I think one of the reasons that he was attracted here was this Ford Foundation money had become available. And he applied for some of it, and it was used to fund this activity. I don't think it was a great deal of money, but it was enough to support some graduate students, maybe support a little travel, some research that he did, and I'm sure some others. And he was able to attract some very good graduate students, and I think some of them at least were supported out of these funds. And If the name changed, I think that the funding really came from the same source, from Van Hise Hall, from the Office of International Studies and Programs. That Ford Foundation money ran out in about 1975, 76. While I was dean, it ran out. And the money for that center, whatever it was called, it was operated by Everett. And that money was gone by before the late 70s.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that clarifies. Thanks. In my review of the changes in the curriculum that occurred around the time that you were director, because of the way the the graduate student bulletins are dated, and because I haven't looked at the master's curriculum committee or the PhD curriculum committee minutes for the purposes of this project, it appears to me that there wasn't a lot of significant change during your tenure as director.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps just previous to that, but it's a little bit unclear from the minutes, but I wondered if you remembered if there was a lot of discussion around.
No, I don't think so. I don't remember anything significant, any significant changes.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember, can you describe the efforts that were made through the executive and or administrative committee to recruit women or minorities? It's more specifically minorities, since I don't think that recruiting women was...
I mean, as students or faculty or both?
Both, but particularly students, I think.
I don't remember any... there was, of course, a lot of attention paid to that by the university administration in the 70s, but I don't remember anything special that IR did that different from what was happening, and of course, we all know that it hasn't been very successful.
Since your administration, what has been your connection with the center in terms of whether you've sat on various committees or what your sense of what the concerns have been since you left?
I don't know. I really haven't had a great deal to do with the Institute since I left.
Mm-hmm.
My attention has been diverted over to the Center for Development, and I've had very little contact with the Institute for the last 7 years or so.
Mm, okay.
I sit on a PhD committee occasionally, but I haven't. And I guess I'm ordinarily on either the admissions committee or publications committee or something like that occasionally, but no, I don't do much.
Mm-hmm. You talked a lot about, you spoke about Jerry Summers and his
mm-hmm.
Impact on the Institute. One of my questions is, besides yourself, who was the most important director of the Institute or the Center in terms of their impact or their legacy?
You mean besides Summers?
No, besides yourself. I mean, I got the impression that Jerry Summers was that person. I wondered if you could elaborate a little bit as to, you know, what his...
Oh, he devoted his main attention to it from the time he came until he died, although he became chairman of this department for 3 years in 68 to 71, but that was the biggest loss we've ever had, was when he died in 1977. He died, I guess, before I became, he convinced me that I should become director, and then he died, and I think I became director then probably in the summer of 77. I'm not sure whether he died after that or before then, but that was just a terrible loss to the Institute, even when he wasn't director. I guess he was director for for I don't know how many years in the middle 60s. But he stood behind the director, whoever he was, all the time while he was alive. And you just can't say enough about his influence on the success of the Institute. He was able to attract money. He was a prolific a writer and researcher. He was active nationally in a variety of ways. He was he and I were the principal officers of the IRA for a long time. I guess he continued after I left. I was Secretary Treasurer from 62 to 73, I think, and he was Secretary Treasurer a little before that, but mostly he was editor, but a very influential person, providing the continuity of that organization for many, many years. He was really just terribly important in the Institute. I'm biased, but I'm he's one of the people I've always admired more than anybody else, and it was just a terrible loss. There's no other director of the Institute that comes close to him in influence and talent and attention that he gave to him. Other than that, of course, Stern has served twice, so you've got to...
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody else served twice? I don't know.
I don't think so. I think Miller served one summer, in addition to his 3-year stint. So, but I think Stern overall served the longest time.
Uh-huh.
Well, probably not as long as Tripp, Reed Tripp did altogether, but...
mm-hmm.
I guess one last question. You commented on the where you saw the direction of industrial relations study going at Wisconsin. I wondered if you could comment more generally as to what trends you see in the study of industrial relations nationally, in terms of topic matter, in terms of structure of various programs and what their emphasis is and will be.
Oh, I guess I don't have any opinion on it different from what you get from probably everybody else. And there's a diminution of the interest in the kind of collective bargaining that was so important in the 50s and 60s and maybe the early 70s, and a greater interest in organizational behavior or whatever its permutations of what it's called. I guess it's really, some people would say it was human relations 20 years ago, but the relations of whether organized or unorganized between management and labor have taken on a different character now, and I think that the industrial relations programs probably all reflect this as to what the structure of the programs are. I think that depends pretty much on their past history and the institutions they're in. As I said about this one here, it seems to me it's the fact that it is an institute and not a department has less to do with the subject matter of industrial relations than it does the place it has in the University of Wisconsin. So I don't know that you can generalize about whether the structure of institutes are going to be interdisciplinary schools or whether they're going to be in business schools or what they're going to be. I think that all depends on pretty much on local arrangements. But in general, answer to your question, I suppose we don't really know whether collective bargaining is passé and is whether it's going to return with greater strength. People that I talk to generally seem to feel that we're in a new age, that something different has taken the place of the traditional collective bargaining kind of adversarial relationships, and certainly the industrial relations schools and institutes and what they offer and what they do reflect that change. And whether it's something that is a temporary aberration from a long-term trend of going back to what it was before, I don't know. I'm not a seer.
I think that's all the questions that I had.
Okay.
I wanted to know if you wanted to say anything else on the record.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Thank you.